That's right. It's 5:30 here at Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. It's time for Rockin' the Boat. My name's the V-Man, and today on the show, I'll be joined by author, filmmaker, scholar, and frequent lecturer at colleges and universities. Saul Landau is in our studios, and we're going to be discussing the Cuba conundrum and other relevant news items in just a moment. Stand by, stay tuned, Rockin' the Boat from 5:30 to 6 o'clock. We'll be taking your calls towards the end of the program, and the number is 831-427-3772. Stand by, stay tuned, Rockin' the Boat coming up next. An author, filmmaker, scholar, and frequent lecturer at colleges and universities, Saul Landau has been a senior fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. since 1972. He has also been a political analyst and commentator on the Pacifica Radio Network. Saul Landau's editorials have appeared in the New York Times and the Washington Post, and he is the author of an Edgar Award-winning book, Assassination on Embassy Row, a report on the murder of Chilean activist Orlando Letelier. He has written several other books, including Red Hot Radio, a collection of his commentaries featured on the now-defunct Pacifica Network News. Currently, Saul Landau is a columnist for Progresso Weekly and is the director of digital media and international outreach programs at California State Polytechnic University at Pomona. He has made more than 40 documentary films, including Who Shot Alexander Hamilton, Quest for Power, Fidel, The Sixth Son, which tells the story of the Zapatista uprising of January 1994 in Chiapas, Mexico, and in collaboration with Haskell Wexler, the Emmy Award-winning Paul Jacobs and the Nuclear Gang, about the effects of low-level radiation on a community near an atomic test site. Saul Landau is the host of Hot Talk, a series of interviews and prominent actors, filmmakers, journalists, and political activists, which are available online with streaming video through MediaVision. His recent projects at Cal Poly Pomona include the documentary films Cuba Today, Maquiadora, A Tale of Two Mexicos, and his new film Iraq, Voices from the Streets. Saul Landau's work has earned him many awards, including the Letelier Moffitt Human Rights Award, a George Polk Award for Investigative Journalism, and a First Amendment Award. It's a real pleasure to have you here in our studios here on Rockin' the Boat, Saul Landau.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for taking the time to be with us. There's a lot to say today, a lot to discuss, and just so little time, but I do have some questions in mind specifically. I want to talk a little bit about Cuba, the subject of your visit to Santa Cruz, and maybe see what other subjects we have time for. Let's begin a little bit by talking about, like I said, the subject of your talk tonight, U.S.-Cuba relations, and you're going to be showing a video that you did recently in January of 2003 with Ricardo Alarcón, who is the president of the Cuban Parliament. And in that interview, you talk about the U.S. war on terrorism. Can you sum up for our listeners what the Cuban government thinks about the U.S. motivations in the world right now?
Well, in the video, vice president, another job of Alarcón is vice president. He speaks about double standards. That on the one hand, the United States has declared a war on terrorism, and on the other hand, it's protecting terrorists, that is, terrorists who don't have an Abu or a Bin or an Abdul in their name, terrorists who happen to conspire and actually carry out violent activities against Cuba, including assassination plots against Fidel Castro. And in it, Alarcón quotes probably the most literary or poetic thing that George W. Bush has ever said. He who harbors a terrorist is as guilty as the terrorist. Well, he's looking in the mirror. The Cubans are understandably upset by U.S. actions in protecting terrorists and encouraging, in a sense, this kind of activity. So that was one of the things, I think, that sparked the, Cuba's arrest of 75 so-called dissidents and sentencing them to long periods in jail or prison. And then subsequently, in another act, sentencing and then executing three hijackers. So U.S.-Cuban relations are tense, and in a sense, they've been tense for 44 and a half years.
You mentioned the hijackers. Just a little bit of conjecture for our listeners. Between mid-March and April of this year, there have been several high-profile hijackings by Cubans trying to get to the United States, and these stories have really hardly made any dent in the mainstream media. Can you give our listeners just a little bit of background about these hijackings and what your reaction has been to the Cuban government's treatment of these people?
Well, the hijackings, I think there have been, over the past 7 years, there's been a spate of them. I don't know exactly how many, but more than seven. Now, what typically happens is a Cuban will hijack a Cuban commercial airliner. He will enter U.S. airspace. He will land in South Florida when he's taken into custody. And then all of a sudden, he appears before a judge and gets bail. And then the aircraft is not returned to Cuba, but rather is auctioned off to pay off somebody who had a lawsuit against some Cuban government official. So, in a sense, what the United States is doing by this behavior is encouraging people to hijack. That is, you can get away with it. And this is the message. Now, if you pair this or couple it with the fact that the United States has cut down on the number of legal visas that it has been issuing to Cubans, that is, United States under the Migration Accord of 1995 is supposed to give 20,000 visas a year for legal migration to Cubans. And people should understand this, that it's in the interest of both countries to have a normalized, routinized migration. Relations between Cuba and the United States have been geographically close forever. And it's only normal that there would be a host of Cubans wanting to leave Cuba and come to the United States. Aside from the pressures placed on Cubans by the Cuban economy today, which is in a very bad situation, this is a normal behavior. If this doesn't happen, you have, over a period of years, a series of, if you like, deluges or waves of rafters or migrants who are not legal. They came in the 60s, and then Mariel, 125,000 came in 1980. And then in the early 90s, when the Cuban economy took a real dive, perhaps 100,000 or more rafters between, say, 1990 and 1993, headed to the United States. And the Florida senators said, hey, enough. And this is not good for our politics. And so they drafted a migration accord. And under this accord, of course, U.S. consular officials screen the Cubans. They screen them so that we want educated people. We want people of good health. We want people without criminal records, without records of long histories in mental asylums. We want people who have affluent families living in the United States, so they won't be public charges. This is what the screeners are looking for. Or to put it another way, we want white middle-class Cubans. All right, that's on the one hand. Now, on the other hand, there's another act that Bill Clinton said he was going to try to repeal, and that was called the Cuban Adjustment Act. Now, try to get this. The Cuban Adjustment Act gives rapid parolee status to any Cuban who puts his foot on U.S. soil, regardless of where he came from, regardless of what his family or education level or health level is. He gets that right by touching American soil. So the exact opposite effect is achieved. All right? Now, the Adjustment Act and the Migration Accord clash. Now, all of a sudden, the Americans cut down on the number of legal visas, and you're having a whole new wave of rafters, or worse, people coming in on smugglers' boats. That is, a Cuban who has a family in the United States will cough up $5,000, maybe $8,000, for a smuggler's boat to go very fast and dump this person somewhere near the shore. Now, if this person can swim to shore faster than the Coast Guard can find him and catch him, because if the Coast Guard catch him, he's repatriated. But the minute he touches American soil, he's got a rapid route to a green card. No other person, only Cubans. Haitians, no. Send them back. Mexicans, send them back. Only Cubans have this right. So the United States has cut down legal visas, and they're essentially encouraging smugglers, rafters, and, of course, hijackers, which is another way to get to the United States.
Okay, now, I don't know how to quite phrase this, but things after the revolution in Cuba seem to have definitely improved for the Cuban people. Why so many rafters and boaters? Why so many people trying to come to the shores of the U.S.?
Well, first of all, let's put it this way. Yes, the revolution improved life enormously for all poor Cubans. It didn't improve life for rich Cubans or for middle-class Cubans. But the majority of Cubans were poor. They were working class or peasant people. So their lives improved immensely. But after 1989, the Cuban economy took a real dive when the Soviet Union collapsed. And Cuba began to look more like a typical third world country. Now, if you ask the question, why do so many Mexicans want to come to the United States? Or why do so many Haitians or Jamaicans or Dominicans or Nicaraguans or pick 'em, Chinese? The answer is, this is where the wealth is. This is where the jobs are. And this is why the people want to come here. If you do a comparison between the number of Cubans who are trying to leave their country for the United States and, say, the amount of Mexicans or Haitians or Dominicans, you would find that the Cubans are far less, significantly less in percentage than all of the other groups. So the answer is, throughout the third world, people are wanting to migrate. There's no jobs. The economy in this age of corporate globalization in most third world countries doesn't generate enough wealth to keep its own population at a minimal level of satisfaction. So that's the real reason for migration. It's not political.
We're speaking with author, filmmaker, scholar, and lecturer Saul Landau. He's joining us live here in our studio, and you can call in with any questions today at area code 831-427-FRSC. That's 427-3772. Saul Landau, for more than 40 years, as we've been talking about, the U.S. has imposed an economic embargo with Cuba, disallowing trade and commerce, prohibiting U.S. citizens from traveling there, etc. You first traveled to Cuba in 1960. Talk a little bit about what are the differences from that time period to now, and also give our listeners, for people like me who've never been to Cuba, what are the consequences for traveling there?
Well, in 1960, I was 24 years old, and people even younger than me were running ministries. This was 1 year after the revolution had triumphed, and it was an exciting place to be. It was creative anarchy. It was a country where all of the laws were changing. The system was changing. You were seeing a very rapid transition from third world capitalism to some form of socialism, but nobody exactly knew what kind yet. And everybody in the revolution, and at that time you could see still the guerrillas who were running ministries now, would see something wrong in the street and call their comrades who were running the ministry of the street or whatever it was and tell them, look, this has to get fixed. It was a time that inspired lots of people who were inclined to social justice and equality, and that's what we were seeing at that time. Since then, I mean, the revolution has succeeded, all right? Let me put it that way. It was a success. It achieved its objectives. It won independence and national sovereignty, one. It made an illiterate or a population that was a third illiterate literate. In fact, Cubans are probably more literate than any other group in this in the lower hemisphere. It took people whose health was not very good and it made them healthy, gave them guaranteed and easy access to medical care. It made Cubans, and this is something few nations can claim in the third world, it made them actors on the world stage. Cubans changed the history of Southern Africa, and I think for the better. I think it is fair to say that Nelson Mandela would not have been president of South Africa had it not been for the Cubans' defeat of the South African armies in Cuito, Cuanavale, and Angola, that Namibia might still be striving for its independence, and that Angola itself might be under the tutelage of South Africa. So that Cuban strength on the battlefield there. The Cubans played a significant role in Algeria and Ethiopia. The Cubans fielded 1,500 troops in the 1973 war in the Middle East, and we don't yet know all that they did in Vietnam. I do know that Castro made a secret trip to Quang Tri province in 1973. This came out in one of the films I did with him, although he wouldn't tell me why. So the Cuban Revolution succeeded. But remember, I use the past tense because I don't know what it is now. I think it's very hard to define Cuba's revolution today. It's in a holding pattern, like an airplane in the sky, slowly sort of burning gasoline. And where it's going to land, I don't know. I don't think anybody knows. I don't think you can plan a long-term economic trajectory based on tourism and remittances. And these are Cuba's main foreign income earners. Remittances, by the way, is first. So what we have today is a third world country with more equality and social justice. It's one of the few countries where the government still provides some part of the citizens' daily needs, not like it used to. There's no more cradle-to-the-grave security as there once was. And, of course, the government still doesn't trust the people to take social initiative. And this is, to my mind, one of the failings of the Cuban Revolution, that there's no societal initiative that's allowed. Blame it on the state of siege, the 44 and a half years of U.S. hostility. Or you can put it another way, Fidel Castro has earned the Guinness record for disobedience.
How many attempts have been made on his life? Quite almost 100 by the CIA, is that right?
Well, he says 620-something. The CIA admitted to the Church Committee, it was to the George McGovern Committee back in, I guess it was 1980. They admitted to, I think, 8. But let's face it, the United States has practiced terrorism against Cuba. There's nothing else to call it. When you try to assassinate the leader of another country, when you try to blow up installations or set fire to them, this is terrorism. And the Kennedy brothers, Bobby and President John F. Kennedy, ordered thousands of these attacks on Cuba. Later on during Nixon, more were ordered. And now more attacks are coming from South Florida. So that Cuba has been a constant victim of U.S. terrorism, ironically, just as the United States is waging a war against terrorism, although I never did understand that concept. I mean, I think of it as a war against drugs, a war against poverty, a war against crime, breast cancer, bad taste. I mean, none of these wars you can be won. And it's sort of, you know, when you put it into that category of unwinnable wars, fighting abstractions, I wonder how serious the war against terrorism really is for George W. Bush.
I'm wondering if you could maybe comment on the use of language and this seeming counterposing of the two terms, terrorism, and that seems to have replaced the Cold War era euphemism was communism. So, I mean, maybe do you see any correlation there? Is there a parallel to be drawn?
Well, I think enemies have become important for imperial powers that are trying to masquerade as republics. Mm-hmm. One of the great hoaxes, when one looks back on it now, was the launching of the Cold War. The Soviet Union at the time, 1945-46, was bleeding. They'd lost 20 or more million people dead, 20 or more million people wounded, 200 cities destroyed. They had no food. The troops had no boots. And the United States and Great Britain announced that the Soviet Union was an imminent threat to invade Western Europe, which was patent nonsense. Now go back to July of last year when George W. Bush announced that Iraq was an imminent threat to the security of the United States. This was certainly a hoax of a much lesser proportion. The Cold War lasted 50 years. But here you have another hoax. Now, communism was an ideological enemy. It had a world base, if you like, and it was ideologically opposed to the institutions of the United States. But, I mean, I think they must have brought Don King into the White House to promote Saddam Hussein as a ranking heavyweight. I mean, this guy wasn't even a 100th ranked flyweight.
Quite an analogy. That's the voice of Saul Landau. He's joining me live here on Rockin' the Boat, and we have about 10 minutes left. We welcome your comments or questions at 831-427-FRSC, 427-3772. Saul, U.S.-Cuba relations recently took a dive. We talked a little bit about the expulsion of the diplomats in mid-May for alleged spying in the United States. May 20th, Cuba celebrates its 101st Independence Day. George W. Bush, president of the free world, in a message to the people of Cuba, in Spanish no less, said, quote, "My hope is for the Cuban people to soon enjoy the same freedoms and rights that we do. Dictatorships have no place in the Americas." That was the quote from Bush. Philip Agee, a former CIA official turned whistleblower, stated his belief in that the recent expulsion of these Cuban diplomats is just another attempt by Washington policymakers to increase tension with Castro in preparation for a war against Cuba. Do you see that this footing that the United States has in the world now and these comments by Bush, do you feel that Cuba's next on the hit list?
Well, let me first correct George W. Bush. May 20th was the day when Spain was overthrown in Cuba, and Cuba became, quote, independent, and the United States inserted an amendment into the Cuban Constitution allowing it to intervene at any time it felt like. It was called the Platt Amendment. At that time, the United States, against objections from Cubans, set up a naval base at the bay in Guantanamo in eastern Cuba. So if you call that independence, it may be something less than desirable. I don't agree with AG. I don't think the United States is preparing to go to war against Cuba. I think the Vietnam syndrome is still intact. The United States doesn't fight anybody who can fight back. And the Cubans can and will fight back, and the Americans know it. I think the servicemen and women in Guantanamo would be under tremendous risk if a war started. I think the Cubans have had many years to aim all their artillery and missiles at them. I think that if the Americans bombed Cuba or bombed Havana, they would kill relatives of some of their top supporters in Miami, some of the people who intimidated the vote counters in Dade County that allowed George W. Bush to become president, would lose their moms and dads, their brothers and sisters, or maybe even their kids. So I don't think that's likely. Finally, several Cuban MiGs have already flown into the United States, so-called defectors, under U.S. radar. Now, suppose these MiGs were carrying missiles or bombs or rockets. Why, they could do damage to Republican estates in Florida. That's a real deterrent.
That's, again, the voice of Saul Landau, author, filmmaker, scholar, and lecturer. He's joining me live in the studio. We do welcome your calls, 831-427-3772. This is Rockin' the Boat. My name is the V-Man. And we just have a few more minutes. I want to maybe just get your thoughts. You produced the documentary The Sixth Son, Mayan Uprising in Chiapas, and in that film you interview Zapatista leader Subcomandante Marcos. Tell me, what did you do to get to him to be interviewed, and maybe some impressions about his character that you feel are valuable to share with our audience?
Well, it turns out that I didn't know this at the time, but Subcomandante Marcos had seen two films of mine. One was Fidel, which I had made in 1968. He'd seen it when he was a student in Mexico. And the other one was a film I made with Haskell Wexler called Brazil, Report on Torture, which he said had a great influence on his life. I didn't even know that one was shown in Mexico. So he knew who I was, and I think probably that was the foot in the door. It was an interesting experience. If anybody hasn't been into the Lacandon jungle in southeastern Mexico, in Chiapas, I would recommend it. It's a great place to live, but especially if you're an insect or a snake. Human beings don't fare so well there. But we learned a great deal. We spent 2 days with Marcos, and he, I think, confided rather intimate things to us, which one can find in the film. If people want to get it, it's available through the Cinema Guild in New York City, along with my Cuba films and the Iraq film and so on. But, you know, Marcos, like most revolutionaries throughout Latin America, is one of Fidel's children. I don't mean biological, right. Ideological children.
And maybe on a final note, if you could just leave our listeners with some thoughts of how maybe we can import some of the strategies used in Chiapas and some of the strategies used in the Cuban Revolution? How can we import that to this country to affect social change on a grand scale here in the United States?
Well, I suppose I could kid you a little bit and say everybody should go up to the Rocky Mountains and practice guerrilla war. No, I'm just kidding. look, I think that we have what we have to learn from both Cuba and from Chiapas are lessons in courage, lessons in solidarity, and lessons in unity. Those are the important lessons. I don't think the tactical stuff really applies to our situation. I mean, we're a very creative people, and the movements in Seattle and in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere have proven themselves very agile, very innovative. The point that people have to learn is get off your butt. Living, making history, you don't always succeed, but your life is a lot more interesting if you get out there and try than it is if you, you know, go shopping or, you know, continue to fantasize about the Maserati that you want.
And that's the voice of Saul Landau, activist, author, filmmaker, scholar, frequent lecturer, and numerous other titles that I could go on and on about. He'll be speaking tonight, The Cuba Conundrum, a commentary by Saul Landau. 7 o'clock tonight, June 2nd, at the LifeSpring Fellowship Hall. That's at the corner of 41st Avenue and Brommer Streets in Capitola. This is $5 to $10 sliding scale donations suggested. No one turned away for lack of funds. Sponsored by the Cuba Study Group, and proceeds will be going to the Alliance of Guama and Santa Cruz County. Again, The Cuba Conundrum, a commentary by Saul Landau. 7 o'clock tonight, June 2nd, Life Spring Fellowship Hall at 41st and Brommer in Capitola. Saul Landau, I really thank you for your time tonight, and any parting thoughts for our listeners?
Well, I think that people should continue to defend the Cuban Revolution and not be afraid to criticize it at the same time. Criticism doesn't mean you're not defending it or you're not loyal to it. A good friend, when he sees something wrong, says so.
All right, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us tonight, Saul Landau. Stay tuned to Rockin' the Boat.
I saw her in the city center with a thermos full of coffee, making the local brew on a street called Salvador Allende. Gave her a peso and took a sip and sat beneath the palm tree. It's so easy to be a criminal when you're trading with the enemy. I sat down on a park bench beside a statue of John Lennon, and to see the children dancing, it's so easy to imagine a world without borders here so close to Miami. As I smoke a cigarro popular, once more trading with the enemy. Biking down a country road, only one of many others, the people call me compañero and they greet me as a brother. One man has a basket full of mangoes. Now I'm sure Jesse would agree. With each bite I undermine my country by trading with the enemy. Watch the oxen pull the carriage and the organic farms abound. All the fertilizer's gone, but there are other ways to feed the ground. Inspiring the world with the strength of creativity. See the past and future come together, trading with the enemy. And I just want to tell you that the enemy's so lovely, such a proud and beautiful people, from the mountains to the sea, from the clinics to the schoolyards, Che Guevara to Marti. We have only our chains to lose by trading with the enemy.